Kia ora koutou, welcome to the panel, RNZ National, Ed Amon and Linda Hallinan with me this afternoon. And I must say to you that we've had a huge response regarding wasps. Thank you to Linda. When I was 5 years old in 1961, I was attacked by an entire nest of wasps, stung almost all over, and I almost died, says one listener. We should make a distinction between native and invasive wasps in Aotearoa. Horticulturalists love native New Zealand wasps. They are wonderful at protecting plants.
Actually, and there's also parasitic wasps, but we don't think of them as wasps because they're so small.
Right. Aaron and Scylla in the Marlborough Sound says, listen to you with multiple stings, 12, after disturbing a wasp nest. Very, very painful. And Mike says, wasps are nothing compared to hornets. Hornets are seriously aggro.
Actually, do we have hornets in New Zealand?
I don't know. Linda.
I feel like we might do. I feel like my grandparents might have had a hornet's nest above their front door once, which everyone was afraid of.
Isn't that a saying as well?
Yeah, like yeah. For obvious reasons.
And someone wants to know, Ed, if there are wasps in Pakistan.
Yes. We've got all of these stingy bits. We've got them and snakes as well. Yeah, so... But a lot of bees and wasps, and if you've got the other one, which is very poisonous for general humankind, is the mosquito. Ah, so we've got both dengue one and the malaria one. Yeah.
First this afternoon, the difficulty in sourcing a local chef or cook to work in our hospitality sector. NZ Ski Chief Executive Paul Anderson is gearing up for the influx of Australian tourists this winter and needs to hire 200 to 300 people. He told RNZ's Morning Report some highly skilled staff, including chefs and cooks, will need to come from overseas as it's very hard to fill the gap with locals. And he's not the only one saying this. Blair Strong is a New Zealand chef and says they're a rare, rare breed like the Kiwi. He said in restaurant associated member and owner of Avachi in Auckland is also with us. She'll be on later. Blair, you first. Kia ora.
Hi, how you going?
Good. And you have described yourself as very, very rare species. How hard is it to hire locals for jobs? What's the issue as you see it?
The issue is general hospitality in New Zealand. It's a fairly low-paid job, and New Zealanders just aren't willing to do it. I started in kitchens over 25 years ago. So back then it was Kiwi chefs and Kiwi kitchens and Kiwi front of house. Nowadays, you'd be hard-pressed to sort of come across a Kiwi in every single kitchen you go into.
And you put that down to you see it as primarily as a remuneration issue, right?
Well, it's partly a remuneration issue, partly a training issue as well. I trained back in the mid-90s and there was a chef shortage then. And it's we've never recovered from that, but we've increased the volume of food eateries and such in the past quarter century.
And that is true, Linda. We've had an explosion of eateries there. And combined with that, as Blair says, the wages as well.
But they haven't just exploded overnight, have they? I mean, this has been going on for 20-odd years. Why have we not managed to encourage people to train? Everyone likes eating out. Why is it that we see such a vast discrepancy between the experience of eating out and the experience of serving that food?
Blair?
Because it's a really hard job to work in a kitchen. And people don't want to do it after working in a kitchen for a little bit of time. They walk away from it.
Describe Ed.
Just solutions wise. I mean, is there no way out other than immigration, or there's something long term that can be done by the Ministry of Education, maybe, or Tourism Ministry of Tourism, to get that training going for interested apprentices for the future?
Yeah, but we have the same problem in the building industry as well. So we don't have enough people to build the houses. We don't have enough people to cook the food. I think it's just generally a population issue with New Zealand.
Blair, someone has said, I worked hospo straight out of school and it nearly broke me. 3 years later and my self-esteem was at an all-time low, never again. Do people underestimate just the pressures of working in a situation like a kitchen in the evenings or whatever?
Yeah. Your pressure comes down to seconds rather than minutes or hours or days or weeks, which everyone else has to deal with. If you don't get something on right now, that means it's going to throw that table 5 minutes behind, which is going to throw the next table 10 minutes behind, which is going to throw the table after that 20 minutes behind. And then you start getting angry customers. So partly, I feel it's also the nature of diners in New Zealand. We're a fairly high expectation.
High maintenance.
High maintenance, yes.
Interesting. All right, okay.
But yeah, it's also because the margins are so slim in hospitality, everyone's running a very tight ship, skeleton staff. And because it's a low-paid job, you don't necessarily get a lot of training in it. Yeah.
Interesting, Blair. Hey, thank you very much for your thoughts. I appreciate your time there. That is New Zealand chef Blair Strong there.
He didn't do a very good job of selling the industry, did he, as a joyous place to work?
Yeah. No, but...
That's one of the problems, surely.
Well, let's go to Mandy Lusk, who has been in... who's a restaurant association member and owner of well-known eatery in the Auckland CBD, Vivace. Mandy, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
What were you thinking when you heard Blair there?
I guess I differ a little bit from where he's coming from, but I'm not a chef. I can cook, but I think the biggest problem in New Zealand is it is very much seen as not a long-term option, cooking. We have a lot of young people that get into it, and the really passionate ones will work here for a few years, but then often take their craft offshore. And they want to go and learn from others overseas. The ones that come back, some of them will come back and end up owning their own places. Some of them will decide it's really not for them. They're pretty antisocial hours, which is one of the big problems. When everyone else is having dinner with friends and family, they're cooking. They're always cooking. And it doesn't tend to work well, especially when people go on and have to perhaps have families and things. It makes it very hard if you're job sharing childcare to stay in our industry. I disagree about the wage thing to a certain extent also. I mean, even our most junior chefs earn the living wage or above. In fact, we have no one who's not above that level in the kitchen. And senior chefs, you know, are earning $80,000, $90,000. And I do understand that in other industries, you know, they earn a lot more than that. The problem is the training at the moment. We don't have enough senior people currently in our industry who aren't running their own small businesses to actually train these people. And if you've got a small restaurant, little suburban one, especially while things are so tight still, and you've only got two chefs in there, you really need both of them have to be able to run that kitchen on their own, and they need to know, you know, there's huge issues these days with food safety plans and health and safety and allergies, you know. You can't have a junior who kills your customers.
Linda, what are your thoughts?
It's just a conundrum, isn't it? Like, I mean, for those of us whose entire experience of hospitality is going out and enjoying ourselves, it's just, you know, that's such a vast gulf between the experience of people doing that job and the people who are paying to be customers. Obviously, we're not paying enough, for starters, or we expect things that are far too fancy. You know, maybe that's why when we were growing up, you could only go to Cobb & Co. because that was actually a profitable way to run a hospitality business. You know what I mean? Like, the food was pretty average.
It's ironic, isn't it, Amanda? Because this at a time where New Zealand food, New Zealand cuisine, is probably as celebrated as I've ever seen it.
Yeah, I mean, we've got amazing food, we've got amazing produce, and we've got some amazing chefs. I mean, chefs are a creative bunch. You know, for them, it's a piece. Every plate that goes out for some of those guys is a piece of art that they're creating, and that's why some of them, you know, they're cool and they're quirky, but it's really hard work, and as Brett said, it's really stressful for them. And the reality is, unfortunately, you can only charge so much for an entree or, you know, a plate of food, and it's the other compliance costs, I think, that make it very difficult.
So for the immediate future, that we've expecting a barrage of Australians coming here and eating at our eateries. Is there a specific push to the Ministry of Immigration or the government to speed track some of the chef applications that might be in the backlog, or something?
Absolutely.
Is something happening in the background?
No, but I know that the Restaurant Association and the Hospitality Association are lobbying strongly. I mean, if they can, particularly if they can get people who've come to work and want to come to work in New Zealand who've been in those big hotels because they have fantastic training systems. Mm. And, you know, if you get one of these people in your restaurant, they can train all your junior staff, and it's really helpful. And I think we just don't have enough. And at the moment, you know, now with these borders open, there's already Australians advertising trying to get the few that we've got here going over there to work. So I think there's about 700 or 800 ads on for chefs in the moment on Seek, and about 500 or 600 on Trade Me.
Goodness gracious!
Oh, wow,
gosh,
yeah.
One final question, Linda.
I'm just wondering, Mandy, so with COVID, obviously, you know, lots of hospitality industry, probably hospitality and tourism have done it the hardest, and so some businesses will have closed. I mean, is there just too many restaurants for the number of skilled staff we have?
Yes, and it sounds dreadful because we're still really suffering. We're still way down on turnover, but we also lost people whose visas expired. Mm. We can't replace them with Kiwis, but it's causing a dreadful situation. You know, we pay our staff hourly. We don't believe in salaries. And so our guys, we're short, but they're working 60 hours, some of them, because like we can't cover sickness, we can't cover anything. So they're getting paid for it, but it does cause burnout. And, you know, it sounds silly to be a business that's still not running anywhere near its full capacity, but we still can't even staff them. And it scares me with those places in Queenstown, when they are going to get really busy, what's going to happen to them?
Which is the issue, isn't it? Mandy, thank you very much again for being with us on the panel. I appreciate it. That is Mandy Lusk, Restaurant Association member and owner of Avanchi in Auckland. Bad response on this. Chefs, this is this person's view. Chefs' wages are terrible, in my opinion. My husband, with 20 years' experience, earns $22 to $24 an hour.
Yeah, that's disgraceful.
That's insane. I mean, it's such a disparity, the amount of work that is needed to do that job, and it's not a 9 to 5 Monday to Friday job. So it's just insane how that exists.
The panel, RNZ National. Nice to have your company. Ed Amon and Linda Helenan with me, 20 past four. Aotearoa could become a right-hand drive dumping ground for dirty cars, the lobby group warns, in an item by Stuff's Joel Maxwell that highlights the issue of New Zealand's car fleet. Drive Electric is a not-for-profit lobby group advocating for electric vehicles, and they want to see a ban on imports of internal combustion light vehicles, your cars, vans, SUVs, by 2030. Japan, India and the UK have all announced fossil fuel vehicle bans by 2030, so this would bring us in line, I guess, with those markets. Catherine Trounson is the chair of the Better NZ Trust, an electric vehicle enthusiast group and charitable trust, and a former winner at the Sustainable Business Awards. Catherine, welcome to the panel.
Good afternoon, Wallace.
Can you hear me okay, Catherine? You're a bit scratchy there.
Yes, good afternoon.
Oh, wonderful. Loud and clear now. So what is your take on this issue? Do we risk becoming the dumping off point for the world's second-hand petrol vehicles?
Well, I suppose that would grab the headlines, but obviously the Climate Change Commission has already suggested that we really shouldn't be importing petrol or diesel cars beyond 2032. So Drive Electric 2030 to be.
Catherine, you're breaking up there. If you could just turn your head or turn your body to the right a little bit and see if we can get you back a bit. Catherine, are you there?
Yes, I can hear you, but you were coming in and out a bit.
Okay, just repeat that again and we'll go to our panellists. But what's the issue as you see it? You say that the Climate Commission has already addressed this issue.
Well, obviously it's still in draft form, but they are suggesting we should not import a petrol or diesel vehicle beyond 2032. So I would certainly applaud Drive Electric for bringing it forward by 2 years, because if we have a hope in hell of achieving carbon neutrality by 2050, then you know, we really have to start pushing people to move to EVs, hybrids and very efficient petrol cars, but we certainly don't want to become a dumping ground and without emission standards, then I suppose a very cheap petrol car from Japan could look quite enticing to people who don't spend a lot of money on a car.
I had a bit of a look at the statistics of the uptake, and just even the last year or a couple of years, the uptake of electric vehicles is quite something, albeit from a pretty low base. But looking at the cheapest new EV at the moment on the market, Catherine, it's still $48,990 plus on roads. They're not cheap, are they?
Look, brand new EVs are not cheap, but then there are only 10 million electric vehicles in the whole world.
Right.
So, you know, the economies of scale have yet to swing in. But what we can always suggest, and it happens with ICE vehicles as well, that people buy them new when they can afford them, and they do actually trickle down the chain, as it were. So you can get a very serviceable second-hand Nissan Leaf for between $10,000 and $15,000. Now that might only have a range of 120 kilometres.
Nissan Leaf, $10,000 to $15,000, Ed.
So, see, my question here is that 2032 is not that far away, right? And I'm just thinking in terms of the infrastructure requirements within the country, because we've got petrol stations every 5 kilometers, 2 kilometers, and but we do not have the infrastructures to have charging stations for general vehicle, city to city travel. In terms of that, what are the basic requirements for us to be ready to for a ban in 2032?
Well, I would just disagree with the statement about the infrastructure. The amount of charging stations up and down the country, if you looked at an app called PlugShare, would show you that the country is covered virtually from north to south. Perhaps the only place where it might appear a little barren would be the west coast of the South Island. But it is perfectly feasible to travel the length of this country in a car with only a range of 120 kilometres. You'll be stopping for coffees and lunches, but you may only be charging for 15 or 20 minutes. So, you know, there is an infrastructure there. It's being built out by a company called ChargeNet at a very impressive rate. You know, they've just put some hyperchargers in at Bombay that can service 4 cars at the same time. I mean, there are huge strides in this area, and we are a country who, you know, live on renewable energy. So, you know, we're as clean and green in the transport sector with an EV as you could possibly want.
What about you, Linda? Did you drive your SUV in today?
I did, but I mean, more than that. I mean, first of all, can I just say, if we're going to have no like new petrol cars by 2030, that just blows my brain. I can't even factor that into my thinking that within less than a decade. But also, you know, my husband runs a roading firm. I just don't understand how this is going to work. Like, what are we going to have? Are we going to have these trucks that haven't been invented yet driving around?
There are already some electric trucks on the road.
Yeah, some though, isn't there? There's very few. it's really interesting. I mean, I guess that's the pace of technological invention, isn't it? It's amazing, but it's
blowing my brain. Can I ask you, why do we hold on to our cars for a lot longer here in Aotearoa? I mean, New Zealand's average car age is 14. The UK's is 7. Why?
Because we can't afford to buy new ones?
No, I would say that was entirely down to climate. In the UK, you get, if your roading starts getting iced up, then they're salted or, which obviously rusts cars, which are still primarily made of, iron. But, I mean, in the US, you would find that they keep their cars for equally as long as we do here. It's just a question that, you know, if the car chassis doesn't last particularly long because of the climatic conditions, then I think that's why the UK have got that idea that they turn their cars over a lot faster than we do.
Right.
But all these things that people are suggesting now is for new cars and imported cars. It's not suggesting that the ICE, you know, internal combustion engine cars on the road in 2030 would all magically disappear with a you know, a wave of a wand. They will still be there, and they will be being moved out of the of the system, as it were, slowly but surely. But it just means that at the top end, you are trying hard to go EV or plug-in hybrid.
All right, Catherine Troughton, Chair of the Better NZ Trust, an EV enthusiast group. Thank you for that.
It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because it makes you wonder whether petrol cars will, in my retirement years, be a bit like, you know, the old flip phone or the big old TVs. What are they called?
When technology changes, it does tend to change very, very fast. It does.
Yeah.
You hear about it and then it flips quite quickly. And if you think of things like the iPhone, for example, it came on pretty quickly. Got a bit of response here. Wallace, a friend of mine recently took 7.5 hours to travel in a Nissan Leaf from Dunedin to Wanaka, 300 kilometres. Steve says, so I'm off to Taupo tomorrow towing a 750kg trailer. Can't do that with an EV.
But you will be able to soon,
but
apparently.
It was strange because I didn't know about this plug share and all that stuff because, I mean, like we had the Smoke 2025 campaign. We need to have some kind of EV 2032 campaign, you know, you might have to hire some advertising agency, not me, but it is needed.
It's remarkable, though, isn't it, to think that, you know, the next generation of children
will learn
to drive in an electric car.
Yes.
I drive a hybrid. I don't think I'm going to go back to petrol.
What are your experiences with a hybrid car?
Oh, it's so good. It's smooth, and I don't have any issues because I do a Prius 1.8. And no problems traveling long term. And also save so much money on petrol.
I find that
previously I had a 1993 Toyota Camry, which every week I was filling it up for $100. And now I spend about $60 to $70 to fill my Prius up, and it lasts me for a week, more than a week, about 2 weeks. And
really?
I'm traveling from Whangaparoa here in town. So it saves you. It does save you a lot of money. But I do get, I mean, with my skin color and my silver Prius, I do get a lot of people waving me down for a particular reason. That is,
they think
I'm an Uber driver. So that doesn't go well, but I like my car. So
Yeah.
I just have such little emotional attachment to cars. Like, I can understand why people who are petrol heads are really, you know, keen on theirs, but I just think of a car as something to get from A to B. So I have no, like, I'd have no ethical dilemma in changing to an EV car.
Peter says it would make far more sense for a country like New Zealand to invest in hybrids with their smaller battery capacities, as frankly, there's not enough lithium and cobalt in the world to replace current petrol and diesel vehicles with full EV vehicles. A good hybrid would be able to allow most people to commute to work without using fuel and recharging the battery once at home.
Actually, it's an interesting point too, because lithium batteries are one of them. You know, it's an environmental disaster waiting to happen. So the kids all know about that too.
Final point of your hybrid, your battery life, fine?
Yeah, I've had it for 3 years. It's going fine at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
And one point on wasp. Tim says, a wee point. Wasp larvae are a delicacy in Japan. There was a wee export industry there for a year or two back in the early 90s. I did try them once at a farewell for a DSIR colleague, parboiled and served as a snack with beer. They were quite tasty. Says Tim, so a little bit of a side note regarding
like peanuts
I don't know. You might want to chew them completely. You don't want them to develop within your gut.
Only at the DSIR, though, eh? That's the sort of farewell you'd get.
We're with Ed Amon and Linda Hallinan this afternoon on today's panel. It's time for headlines with Marama Te Pōle.